tackle kingdom access. Today, we move on to focus on a related topic, radical kingdom hospitality. Now, the first part of this morning's gospel story is an easy story to share with children. You see, they always want to be first, especially when they are in preschool. They want to be the line leader. They all want to be the line leader. And so to talk to them about thinking they're the line leader or the star pupil or whatever position of honor there is, only to have the teacher call someone else up, they can understand that and relate to that feeling. And so you can explain this story to them easily. And from an adult perspective, we can grasp the practical nature of Jesus' advice with regard to places of honor. It would be horrifying to assume that we were among the honored guests at the head table and then to discover that others had been invited to be there instead, and by then finding that nothing was left but one of the back tables and how uncomfortable we would feel. So that advice from Jesus is as applicable today as it was in the first century. It is the second part of Jesus' teaching, the part about inviting those who cannot reciprocate, that may be harder for us to accept and to practice. If we had read the epistle lesson from Hebrews today, we would have been reminded that in the process of entertaining strangers, we may actually be entertaining angels without knowing it. If we think to Matthew's gospel, to the 25th chapter, we can remember that story about when we welcome the least of these, when we care for the least of these, we are actually doing those things for Jesus. So we have a lot of scripture that supports Jesus' teaching on inviting those who cannot reciprocate. But most of us are used to reciprocal hospitality. We are used to inviting and spending time with our relatives, with our friends and our church friends. We may spend time with coworkers. We may spend time with people from our own social circles. That's what we are comfortable with, being with people who are just like us, who share our values, and people who can often reciprocate. And in some circumstances, there are even rules to keep things reciprocal. In business, it is often said, you give down, but you do not give up. The boss may give gifts, but those under the boss probably do not give up again because people might see that as trying to buy favor or buy a promotion. The boss may have the party and entertain those who work for him or work for her. But chances are the employee is not going to invite the boss. Maybe to a family wedding if the boss knows their children, but beyond that, probably not. And in the military, there are non-fraternization rules. Officers and enlisted personnel do not generally socialize together or date or marry. It gets complicated if they do. We tend to build relationships with people in our own social circles, and many Christians have few, if any, unchurched friends. We get used to doing things here at Orms with each other, and we lose track of our unchurched neighbors or coworkers or friends. But Jesus offers us a very different model for hospitality and for relationship building. He challenges us to avoid building relationships that will benefit us, and instead to extend hospitality to those who cannot possibly repay us. That is the kind of hospitality that God offers us, regardless of our social status. It is the kind of hospitality that Scripture requires, even though the religious leaders of Jesus' day were not practicing it. And as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, when Jesus, when we were talking about Jesus' teaching on prayer, and when we use that parable about the man going to his neighbor at midnight in order to care for his guests, in biblical times, when you welcome someone into your home, you accepted responsibility for all of their needs. Not just a meal and a place to sleep, but whatever needs they had, you accepted responsibility. Reciprocal hospitality is a lot easier than the biblical hospitality that Jesus teaches. So let me tell you a story that offers us a taste of kingdom hospitality. It is a story that I ran across a few weeks ago on Facebook, and it is a story about a man who had signed up for a church leadership conference at a large church in his own denomination. And it turns out that that man had a very serious allergy to tree nuts. It was such a serious allergy that the slightest trace of any type of nut could cause him to need to be rushed to the hospital with anaphylactic shock. It was absolutely life-threatening. So he arrived at this conference, and when he discovered that they were going to serve communion, he became concerned because he realized something that I did not know. Sometimes bread can have traces of tree nuts in it, depending on how and where it is manufactured. So he called over some of the hospitality people at this big church conference, and he inquired about the ingredients in the bread and was there any cross-contamination. Well, they not only checked out the label on the bread bag, they weren't sure after they did that, and it was during the week, and so they made a phone call to the manufacturer, and they discovered that it was, in fact, processed in a plant where there just might be traces of tree nuts in that bread. And so they came back to their guest and they said, "We've checked and it's probably not safe for you to share in this bread." And the man said, "No problem. I'm fine not receiving communion. I'm fine not coming to the table. I understand that you simply cannot deal with every food allergy, and mine is kind of severe and kind of unique. I'm not going to take a chance. Don't worry about it." Well, they did worry about it because they wanted to extend radical kingdom hospitality. And so when the time came for communion, this man, who was one out of 575 guests, was amazed when one of the hospitality people came and stood next to where he was sitting, and they had a cup of grape juice, and they had a small container of Pringles. They had checked what they had on hand. They had called the manufacturer and verified that, yes, there would be no tree nuts in these Pringles. And they cared about this one out of 575 guests so much. And it was so important to them that he could share fully in the entire event and that he would be welcomed at the Lord's table, that they went out of their way to make it possible for him to participate. One out of 575. Jesus only talked about one out of 100 when he talked about leaving 99 sheep behind to go and look for one who was lost. These folks went far enough to care for one out of 575. You see, when they welcomed him as one of the 575 church leaders attending their conference, they accepted full responsibility for all of his needs. And they rose to the occasion with radical kingdom hospitality. And to help us remember and embrace the idea of radical kingdom hospitality, I'm going to ask the ushers to bring each one of you some Pringles. I'm serious. Here they come. while you are receiving those tangible reminders of radical kingdom hospitality, I will be sharing a far more dramatic story of radical kingdom hospitality. It is a story that began almost 18 years ago on the morning of 9/11. It is a story that began on a flight that did not receive any headlines on that day or in the days to come. It's a story that began on a flight that did not make the news because its passengers and its crew not only survived, but they thrived. And they thrived along with passengers and crews of 52 other flights because they received radical kingdom hospitality. Delta Flight 15 was about 5 hours out of Frankfurt, Germany on the morning of 9/11. They were flying over the North Atlantic on their way to the United States when the captain summoned the lead flight attendant to the cockpit. When he entered the cockpit, he said the crew had all business looks on their faces, and the captain handed him a printed message from Delta headquarters in Atlanta. And that message read simply, "All airways over the continental United States are closed to commercial air traffic. Land ASAP at the nearest airport. Advise your destination." That is all the information that they had, but they knew it must be serious. They had no idea how serious until the next day, but they knew it was serious. The captain determined that the nearest airport was 400 miles behind them in Gander, Newfoundland, in Canada. So he requested an immediate route change from Canadian air traffic control. And he was amazed when they granted immediate authorization, no questions asked. In the interest of not upsetting their passengers, they decided that they would lie to them, at least temporarily. They told them they had some instrumentation problems and they were just going to make a quick stop in Gander, Newfoundland to have it checked out. They were just sure if they told them that there was some kind of problem that they would go into panic. Better to lie to them temporarily. Meanwhile, as they prepared the plane for landing, they received two more sketchy messages from Delta headquarters in Atlanta. The first told them that there was some terrorist activity in New York City. That was it. The second one said there had been some hijackings. They landed in Gander at 12:30 p.m. local time, which was 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, roughly 2 hours after that first plane hit the World Trade Center. Not that they knew that at the time. And at that point, there were already some 20 planes on the ground in Gander. Those planes were from all over the world, and they had all had to make a detour on their way to the U.S. As they landed and stopped the airplane, the captain made an announcement. He said, "I'm guessing you're looking at all these planes and thinking they all can't have an instrumentation problem. We're here for another reason." And then he told them what little they knew. And there were gasps in the cabin, and people were upset and panicking as they knew was going to be the case. And no one could leave the plane until the Canadian government figured out what was going on. They had taken charge, and I'm sure they were in consultation with security people, with intelligence people in the U.S. and in other places in the world. I'm sure they were checking passenger rosters and making sure there were hopefully no terrorists on any of these planes. Meanwhile, in the next hour or so, the crew began to receive a little bit more information in bits and pieces. The passengers could not get cell phone service, which was very disturbing to them. But the crew had a little bit of sketchy information. They now knew that planes had been flown into the World Trade Center. They knew that a plane had been crashed into the Pentagon. And more planes continued to land during the hour. And this relatively small town of Gander wound up welcoming a total of 53 airplanes from all over the world. 27 of those planes were U.S. passenger jets. And the town of Gander, population of about 10,400, wound up with approximately 10,500 temporary displaced guests who needed radical hospitality sooner rather than later. And they rose to the task with the aid of surrounding communities within a 50-mile radius. It was 6 p.m. before arrangements were in place to begin deplaning the passengers and crews one plane at a time. And Delta 15 was informed that their time to deplane would be 11 o'clock the next morning. But the plane lavatories were serviced for all of the planes, and water was delivered, and they were told medical care was available for any passenger who needed it on any plane. And fleets of school buses soon began to arrive at the airport. As passengers deplaned, they went through customs. They registered with the Canadian Red Cross, who got all of their contact information, determined all of the needs they might have, any special needs, be they dietary or medical. They kept track of which planes they were on because they knew and they hoped the time would come when they'd return them to those planes and eventually get those passengers to their destinations. Finally, when that was over, flight crews were taken by vans to small hotels in the Gander area. Elderly passengers were welcomed into private homes. No one wanted them on a cot or in a sleeping bag, so they were welcomed into private homes. A pregnant passenger who had been on flight 15 that day, who was about 33 weeks pregnant, was also welcomed into a private home, and that home was located right across the street from a 24-hour emergency medical facility, just in case. They thought of everything. High schools in Gander and in nearby communities were all closed. High schools and other meeting facilities had all been converted into shelters. Some had cots, some had mats with sleeping bags and pillows. I'm not sure how these small towns pulled it all together that quickly, but they figured it out. The high school students who were out of classes as a result were required to offer hospitality to their guests. Nurses, both male and female, were available 24/7 in every facility. Families were kept together, and everyone was granted phone or email access at least once a day so they could contact loved ones. They were all given tokens for local laundromats so that they could wash their clothes because all of their luggage was still on the plane. Bakeries stayed open late to provide for all of the town's unexpected guests, and local residents prepared and delivered food to all of the schools and shelters. The Canadians did everything in their power to care for the physical needs of their unexpected guests. And they also realized that the demands of hospitality went beyond meeting physical needs of their guests. Their displaced guests were also going to need emotional hospitality. They had no idea when they would return home or get back on a flight and return to their destination. Just imagine how those with family in the U.S. must have felt not being able to be with them as they received more news of what had happened the day before. Just imagine how panicked they must have been. And if we apply the rule of 7 degrees of separation, well, that means that we are all only 7 people away from anybody else in the world. So I'm pretty sure that many of those 10,500 displaced people knew someone who knew someone who knew someone who had been in the World Trade Center that day, or who had been at the Pentagon, or who had been in that Pennsylvania town where the plane went down. Certainly their emotional stress must have been high. The uncertainty, the anxiety must have been rising. And so they needed emotional hospitality as well as physical hospitality. And transportation was provided so that they could go to local restaurants of their choice where they could sit down and have a meal in a different setting so they didn't have to look at just four walls and a shelter all of the time so that they could feel a little bit more normal. During the day, they were offered excursion tours. There were sightseeing opportunities. They could take cruises on local lakes and harbors. They could take hiking trips in nearby forests. The local residents did everything in their power to provide radical hospitality to their 10,500 unexpected guests. And the crew of Delta Flight 15 said that when their passengers were finally back on board, it was more like they were returning from a cruise than from having been temporary refugees in the aftermath of a terrorist attack. Now, I do not know if any of their Canadian hosts and hostesses were familiar with Jesus' teaching from Luke 14. I don't know if they were familiar with the requirements of biblical kingdom hospitality, but that is the type of hospitality that they provided under totally unexpected emergency circumstances. When the Canadian government granted access to those 53 planes, along with their passengers and crews, they accepted responsibility for all of their needs, and they rose to the occasion with radical kingdom hospitality, hospitality that their guests would never, ever be able to repay. It does turn out that the passengers on Delta Flight 15 made some subsequent arrangements to help 134 high school students with scholarships, but no repayment was expected. And there is nothing that I can find in the story, no indication to suggest that the Canadian government requested or expected reimbursement from the U.S. government or from any other government. They realized that their U.S. neighbors had far more pressing matters to attend to, and no one knew what might unfold in the days to come in the U.S. or anywhere else in the world. Those were scary and uncertain times. So they just welcomed 10,500 unexpected displaced refugees. They welcomed them as their guests with no idea of how long they might need to care for them. And for a few days, those unexpected guests were the equivalent of the poor and the physically challenged, whom Jesus tells us to invite. They had only the clothes on their backs. Chances are they did not have enough money to pay for anything during an extended stay. They were totally unprepared. They were emotionally traumatized, which can be every bit as serious as being physically challenged. For a few days, those unexpected guests were the equivalent of the poor and the physically challenged, whom Jesus tells us to invite. And their Canadian hosts rose to the occasion, and they fulfilled the demands of radical kingdom hospitality. Now, I am not expecting a plane, not even a small one, to land on our church parking lot. I had a few amusing thoughts about hooking up those skyways, one to the sanctuary level, one to the fellowship hall level, and solving our accessibility problems. Kind of chuckled at that, but I'm not expecting even a small plane to land on our parking lot here at Orms. I'm not even expecting a lot of extra cars, except, of course, on Thrift Shop Saturday, when we do an amazing job of offering hospitality to those in need. Perhaps we could do more, but at least they can come and feel good about being able to purchase what they need and maybe some extra things for a very small amount of money. I'm not expecting anybody to arrive with large vans, with buses, with planes. But that does not mean that we can forget about Jesus' challenging teaching on hospitality. Many of the people who desperately need to experience radical kingdom hospitality may never make their way through the doors of this or any other church. It's just not on our society's radar screen. Not at all. They're not thinking about needing church. That's sad, but that is so, so true. Generations have been away from the church, and it is no longer something that society says they even need. And they don't know that the thing they are longing for is a relationship with Jesus in Christian community. So we will need to offer them radical kingdom hospitality as we build relationships with them in non-church settings. And that is the type of hospitality that Jesus taught, and it is the type of hospitality that Jesus demonstrated. Yes, Jesus taught in the synagogues, but he did not spend all of his time there just waiting for people to come through the doors. Jesus spent the lion's share of his time teaching and healing and building relationships in places where people worked and in places where people gathered and in places where people shared table fellowship. And those are the settings where we will need to offer all kinds of hospitality as we build relationships. We often think of evangelism as how in the world do we fill our pews? And certainly I would love to see that happen. I know this is where we often experience Jesus, and it's hard to think about faith in other settings. But if we are not careful, we just might wind up practicing what one of our conference leaders refers to as vampire evangelism. We need new blood, and then we get them here, and we drain them of that new blood as quickly as possible. That's not radical kingdom hospitality. That's not evangelism. It's not about filling the pews as much as we'd like to see that. Instead, it involves radical kingdom hospitality. It is about building new relationships and nurturing those relationships in non-church settings and expecting nothing in return for ourselves or for the church. We may receive more than we give without expecting it through the richness of those relationships. We will probably plant seeds that someone else may water and nurture over time. And God has ways of bringing people into the kingdom that are beyond our understanding. But we may never benefit from it. Evangelism involves building new relationships and nurturing those relationships in non-church settings and expecting nothing in response. We need to welcome people into community pews and into virtual pews, even if they never make it to our physical pews here at ORMS. We need to welcome people as they are and where they are. And so our hymn of response is Welcoming God, and it is to the tune of Blessed Assurance. You'll find the words on the screen and in your bulletin.